you. So I want to start with a little quiz, mainly for the over 70s. So most of you probably won't know the answer to this. What happened 50 years ago on the 23rd of June? Remember, 50 years ago, 1967. It was the Summer of Love, remember. This is the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love. And I'm an old aging hippie. June 23rd, 1967 was the first ever global television broadcast. And it was called One World. And one of the presentations on that program were the Beatles live doing the final recording of All You Need Is Love. Which to me is like, it's really, as I'm an aging hippie, you have to allow me this. But it's like, that to me was really significant. The first global television broadcast was the Beatles singing to the world, All You Need Is Love. And in a way, that's sort of become the anthem of the time, and it's something which is 50 years later, we hear that song and we all go, yes, all you need is love. Tim was talking yesterday about love. So many teachers have said that it's about love. It's all about love. And there's a line in that song which they sing so fast that we miss it. Nothing you can do, but you can learn to be you in time. Nothing you can do, but you can learn to be you in time. It's easy. All you need is love. And what are we doing here? In time, 50 years later, we're learning to be you. We're learning to be ourselves. And what I want to start with is just looking at, in a sense, what happened there, where we've come from today. And I think we've been on this incredible spiritual journey which started in the 60s. It's more than just a spiritual journey, it's a cultural journey. Because that was the real beginning of the feminist movement, the women's movement. It was the beginning of alternative health, yoga coming in, organic food, the gay liberation. Homosexuality was decriminalized last month, 50 years ago in England. And it was really the beginning, the 60s, of the whole spiritual renaissance that we have been in the last 50 years. I call it the Awakening Project. Ken Wilber talked about it as the Atman Project. Atman being the Indian word for self. The rediscovery of who we are. And of course the Beatles, 2 months later, 2 months after this global broadcast to the world, All You Need Is Love, the next great headline they made was teaming up with the Maharishi and starting to meditate. The whole 60s had been powered, not the whole 60s, but part of the revolution had obviously been that whole psychedelic revolution that had been going on. And then there was the whole movement to say, okay, yes, you can get incredible states of consciousness with psychedelics. And they were a great opening. And yet there was this sudden realization, those guys out in India, they know something too. And it was like, okay, we leave behind that. Let's go to India and see what they know. And I was part of that, and I jumped in my VW bus, and we drove to India. We did. We just got in our VW, our Volkswagen bus, and we drove to India, which was an amazing journey in itself. So that was really one of the seeds that really brought meditation into the world. If they hadn't started, it would have happened anyway. If the Beatles hadn't started TM, I think things would have got going a lot, lot slower. It was inevitable it was coming, but they sort of, they accelerated the whole process of awakening. And almost, I feel, if they had a spiritual mission, they were sort of building up to that, and that then their peak was 67, then leaving that message, all you need is love, and let's try meditation. And here we are. We've been through the guru phase, everybody flocking to India, finding gurus, or gurus coming here. Then we went through the whole workshop phase. Some of you remember that, ests and actualizations and all that stuff going off on long, intensive stuff to really get down and be true to ourselves. And then we had the Buddhist wave, really through the 80s, Tibetan Buddhism starting coming in. Well, so it was there the whole time, but being recognized. Now, of course, you know, mindfulness is the big buzzword in corporations. We're talking about we must all be mindful. And non-duality is like here, now, the edge of that whole wave that's been building over the last 50 years. We are now, you know, talking about non-duality, which has always, always been the essence of all the great spiritual teachings. It's always been there, that core essence. But it's been dressed up in all this other paraphernalia and rituals and dogma. And I mean, what's happened in the past is, I'm talking the distant past here, there's been somebody had an awakening experience, great personal enlightenment, awakening, something happened, whether it was through accident, lots of meditation, some spiritual darshan, who knows, but they had an awakening experience and discovered that love, that essence of self for themselves, and obviously wanted to share it. It's really, it's so life transforming, but also so lovely and delicious that they wanted to share that with other people. And so they started telling their friends or whatever it was, and their friends became followers, and they perhaps got 90% of it or 80% of it, but bits they didn't quite get and bits they didn't quite understand. And when they told their friends, they added a bit in which wasn't there initially or their interpretation, and then their friends went on and got 90% of that and added a bit of their own stuff in, and then it got translated into another language, and some of the words got translated wrong, and then in another culture, and it got different, got a little different interpretation, and ended up as what we call religion. I think that every religion started off from that same, very, very similar core revelation, core spiritual awakening. And then over time, the truth just got gradually lost. I sometimes call it truth decay. The truth gradually decays over time. Bits get added in, rituals get added on. It gets absorbed by the culture of the time and ends up with these things that look totally different. And so people then start arguing, well, you know, is the Hindu version right or is the Catholic Church version right? They're both wrong as religions, because they've lost touch with what is that essential teaching. And what is significant, I think, about this last 50 years is we've been stripping away all that stuff that's been added on, getting down to what is that essential teaching, getting down to the core. And that's what I think makes this the most significant spiritual time in the whole of human history. Because what's happening now is totally different. We are, again, many people discovering that essence for themselves, but now it's not being sort of contained or understood within a particular cultural framework of, you know, whatever it is, Eastern Orthodoxy or some Taoist formula. It's not being understood within a particular framework. We have access to all the world's religions present day and past. And we do that. I'm sure many of you, we go and, you know, read what the Upanishads were saying 2,500 years ago, or what some of Buddha's followers were saying, or what Sufi teachers were saying, or what teachers today are saying. We have access to all the world's spiritual traditions. And so we can actually begin to see what is that common essence. We need to see that common element. So we're stripping things away rather than adding in stuff. We're taking away all the stuff that's been added on. And of course, what's really made that so much easier today is the media. We have access to all these teachings, whether it's through books. For a long time it was books, and then another thing that happened in the 1960s was cassette tapes. We could actually take recordings around with us and listen to them in your car while you were driving. And then the Walkman came along. We could put it in our pocket and listen to teachers. And then, of course, CDs, videos came in. There was no videos back then. We have videos. Now we don't need even cart the videotape around or the DVD. We're streaming online. We can have access to all that's happening in potential in this spiritual renaissance. It's so, so accessible. And I think we often overlook just what a precious time this is to be able to have this access to global wisdom, all of the global wisdom, so easily. And this is part of it, coming here. We have a wealth of wisdom from many different traditions, from all of us. Each of us are on our own journey, and we all have something to share in this journey. And what is happening now is, rather than there being some awakened being who is sharing his or her awakening with everybody, we are all waking up together. And you see this now. Now you don't need to go to India. You know, you come here. There's so many teachers that, you know, names I'm sure we all know, some of them people who are here, who had their own awakening experience and sharing that. So we now, in our midst, as a culture, we have the awakened masters emerging, all of whom have come here through their own individual work, their own journey, their own practice. And so our whole culture is waking up. When I say our whole culture, of course, I don't mean everybody in our culture. There's a lot of people who are still very fast asleep. But I mean this movement, this spiritual renaissance that we're all, in one way or another, engaged in. We're all waking up in that way. And so what I want to look at just very briefly is what I see as the essence of what's being rediscovered. The emphasis on rediscovery. Nothing new is happening, but we are rediscovering for ourselves that essential spiritual message. And the first thing, and it's so obvious, is, you know, what are we looking for? Behind everything we do, what we're ultimately looking for is, give it different words, to be happy, to be at peace, fulfillment, satisfaction. We're looking for an inner state. We're looking for a better state of mind, a better state of being. To put it in the most generic form, we're looking to feel okay inside. Now that, I'm sure for most of you, is no great revelation. 50 years ago, that was. You know, we were so trapped in the system that said, you know, life is about whatever it was, getting a refrigerator, color television. Color television didn't exist then, but getting more things, that's where happiness lay. Now that conditioning is still there, but we're realizing, no, that's not true. It's not through what you have or do. But what we're looking for is that. We're looking for happiness, peace of mind. We can give it many, many different words. But that's ultimately what we're looking for. And what our culture does is take us away from it, ultimately. It takes us in the opposite direction. So our culture hypnotizes us into the belief that if you just had the right things, you'd be happy. And it seems to work. It seems to work. But it's really covering up something much deeper. And this is, I think, what the Buddha realized so clearly is the reason we're unhappy is because we think there's something missing, there's something wrong, we think we lack something. That's why we're unhappy. Not because we need the things to make us happy, but it's the act we create discontent. We create discontent. And in our whole culture, every advertisement you see, in one way or another, is making you discontent. It's saying, you cannot be happy as you are with your current credit card. Here's something better. But, you know, you must be dissatisfied with something, and then we're going to offer you something better. It's creating discontent. The sad joke is the mind in its natural state is content. But we create the discontent. We overlay it with artificially created discontents. I think a wonderful illustration of this I love is what the internet has shown us is when you go shopping on the internet, you know, you go and buy yourself a new piece of clothing, a new jacket or something. You go online, you find the right price, the right style, the right color, everything, and you finally press buy now. And you feel good. It's another 3 days before it actually arrives. So it isn't that the jacket's made you feel good, it's the pressing buy now has made you feel good. And the reason you feel good is now that one particular lack, that one particular discontent is now no longer bothering you. Something else is going to come up. Probably when the jacket arrives, you realize it isn't quite the color you thought it was going to be, and you move back into discontent again. But the point is, we are making ourselves discontent, which is, you know, part of the essence of non-duality is there's nowhere we need to go to find happiness. We have to stop trying to go there, have to stop trying to find it. It's the trying to find it that gets in the way of our living it. And this is probably the second thing that's almost universal in every teaching is how our thinking gets in the way. And by thinking, I mean that internal conversation we have with ourselves most of the time. I say most of the time, some of us it's probably 99.99% of the time, there's a chatter going on. It's your own voice talking to you about what's going on and how nice that person is and that's that and what the weather going to be like tomorrow and God, isn't the food good here? And you know that conversation that goes on? All the time that's going on, that's hiding that natural state of contentment, which is why so many traditions have said in one way or another, we have to transcend thinking, we have to go beyond the thinking mind, because what you're looking for is within you. The kingdom of heaven is within you. But of course, our whole culture keeps us looking out there for it. And the third common element to just about every tradition is how when we get caught in our thinking, because most of our thinking, most of it is about us, me, what I need, what I don't want, what's good, what I think the president should be doing or whatever. It's all about us in some way or another. And so we create, in our thinking, we create this sense of being a separate individual self with this image of ourselves based upon our physical body that's going through this world with its, on its own particular hero's journey with all its ups and downs. And we identify with that constructed sense of self that we live in our thinking. And again, what all the traditions are saying in one way or another, we have to let go of that or step out of it or not take it so seriously. Again, that's got corrupted and where people say, oh, you've got to get rid of your ego. It's not about getting rid of it. It's about seeing it for what it is and not being caught up in it and being able to come back and reconnect with that deeper sense of beingness, that sense of I that's always, always there, but we don't normally notice. And by that sense of I, just when we say the word I am, is that I that knows that I am. That's that deeper sense of self, that sense of being, that sense of presence, which, as Tim was pointing out last night, cannot be defined, you cannot put any labels on it, but we all know it all so well. It's that same sense of being I that was there yesterday, that was there 20 years ago. All my life, my personality, all of that may have changed to some extent, but that sense of being me never changes. And that's what they're all pointing to coming back to recognizing that. The teaching that I've really been loving at the moment, not just teaching, it's a very simple statement on this, which I find so profound, which is, or are the opening lines of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And any of you who do yoga, most yoga schools give lip service to this. I was at a yoga ashram recently where everybody was wearing t-shirts, and this phrase was all across the front of their t-shirts, and it's that line in Sanskrit, which is yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Some of you may know it, but don't worry, I'll explain it. This is the first line of the Yoga Sutras, written by Patanjali. Sutras in Eastern traditions, the word sutra means thread. And you have to remember, you go back 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years, particularly when some of these things were first written down. They weren't written down. When they were first discovered, the whole tradition was oral. Everything was passed on by word of mouth. And so what the teachers did would collapse their teaching into these sutras that everybody could remember. These particular four words, these particular four words. And so it was all about learning these sutras. And then what you did afterwards, as you passed the sutras on, was you could unpack them. And by unpacking the sutras, a whole meaning, discourse, teaching came out of it. So the first line, it isn't actually the first line, it's the second line of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. The first line of the Yoga Sutras, for those who are really academic about it, the first line says, here begins the teaching on yoga. The second line, for those who are pedantic, yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the first one. What does yoga mean? I think many of you know the root meaning of yoga is to yoke back, to tie back, to bring unity. And the way that's often translated is about, oh, it's becoming one with God, about becoming one with the universe. It's about finding oneness with something, about yoga, it's about joining. I actually see it as something different. It is about oneness, it is about yoking, coming back. But I see it as the end of separation, the end of that sense of separation that we have of me being a separate, individual, little self struggling to get through this world with all my likes and dislikes and what are people going to think of me, blah, 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 blah. That's that individual self which is it's got separated from that sense of I-ness, that sense of beingness. So yoga for me is oneness. But it's the oneness that comes when the separation that we live in dissolves. Chitta means consciousness. Vritti means whirling, the whirlpool. The whirling of consciousness, which is the thinking world we spend so much of our time in, that whirling around of thinking about this, thinking about that, that whirling of consciousness. And Nirodha means ceasing. And it's interesting how our translation of those four words has evolved over the last 50 years ago. You go back to looking at translations of these Indian texts written, you know, back in the early part of the 20th century, and it was about, you know, yoga comes from the restraining of the whirling of mind stuff, from the restraining of thought. You have to stop it. You have to cease thinking. You have to control the mind. You have to stop it. Which, as anybody who's tried to do that, you know, is virtually impossible, and you might succeed if it takes years and years and years and years of trying to stop it. Now, modern translations are about allowing that to cease. So the end of separation comes, the end of that inner separation comes when we allow that whirling of mind stuff, the thinking, to cease. And now even more modern translations see it as not even ceasing, but as freedom from. Freedom from the whirling of mind stuff, freedom from the thinking. The end of separation comes when there is freedom from the thinking. So that's the first line, which I say is just about in every yoga school. Then the second two lines get interesting. The next line says, then there is abiding in the true nature of the knower. Then there is abiding in the true nature of the knower, of that which knows, the self, the knower, that sense of I, which is aware of every single experience we ever had. When the whirling of mind stuff ceases, then there is abiding in the true nature of the self, in the true nature of the I am. And then the third line is almost always, to my mind, mistranslated. The third line says, otherwise, there is identification with the whirling of mind stuff. That's what it actually says. The way it's nearly always translated is, otherwise, the knower, the self, identifies with the thoughts. But anybody who's really gone into non-duality in any depth, you know that knower, that true sense of I, the I am, doesn't identify with anything. It is just what sometimes called the silent witness. It is that which is knowing experience. It doesn't identify with anything. The identification is happening within the whirling of mind stuff, within the thought system. There is the identification within that thinking mind. You think, I am this little, small, little, vulnerable, fearful, hopeful, excitable personality. That's all within the whirling of mind stuff. The knower, consciousness, doesn't identify with that. So when we go beyond the whirling of mind stuff, there's the end of separation, and we come to know the true nature of I. That's what it's saying, so simply. And so, how do we do that? And I think what has happened in this journey of the last 50 years in our culture is, as we've begun to dive into it, it's got simpler and simpler and simpler and simpler. Easier and easier and easier. You know, one way of framing the whole, you know, non-dual philosophy, I don't particularly like using those words, one way of framing it is, there's nothing to do. There's nothing we actually have to do. We have to stop the doing that takes us away from it. That's almost part of, you know, if it's a first dogma of non-duality, it's there's nothing to do. There's nowhere else we are trying to get to. That's the simplicity of what's coming out of all this. It just gets simpler and simpler and simpler. And, you know, this is the theme which is, you know, part of so many of the people here who have things to share, is their own way of, their own simplicity of what it's all about. And as it gets simpler, it just gets easier and easier and easier. If there's nothing to do, that cannot be hard. What becomes difficult is when we try to think, well, what do I need to do in order not to do anything? And there's a lot of that around. And in fact, most of the traditions or the practices are all about finding ways to around this whole conundrum of how to let go, how to completely let go. And as I was saying this morning in the meditation, you know, the biggest battle people have in meditation is how to stop thinking, I must stop my thoughts. No, just step out of them. And that's what I would like to sort of offer you here this afternoon as a simple practice that I find probably the simplest practice I've come across for myself. And for the moment, I'll probably say something different another year, but for the moment, the most profound and valuable practice is to realize we can all, any time we choose, we can pause. We can stop thinking for a moment. We could just pause. Whatever you're doing now, wherever your mind is going, it may not be following me, but if it isn't, then just hear this bit. Wherever your mind is going, whatever it's thinking about, blah, 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 stop. It's going to come back again. Probably about 2 seconds later, it'll come back and you'll be off on some other journey, whatever it is. But we have that power to pause. Just for a moment, we can step out of that habitual inner dialogue with ourselves. And what do we notice when we do that? If I might summarize what usually comes up. Firstly, we become aware of the present. Oh, there's the sound of that fan I hadn't noticed. Oh, there's this, there's something else. Oh, I've got an itch in my body. The present reveals itself. Again, people say, oh, I've got to be more present. There's nothing you can do to be present. You've got to stop doing the things that take you out of the present. And what takes us out of the present is our thinking. So our thinking is always about the past or the future or something in some way or another. So when you pause your thinking, just in that moment of pausing, you become more present. You become more present to your experience in that moment in the world. But that's just the beginning. That's like the entry point. Then, in that pausing, noticing how does it feel? Not what are you noticing, how does it feel when you pause like that? And again, the sort of words that people come up with very often is like, oh, there's a sense of relief, or a sense of ease, or it's okay. Or some people may talk about, oh, there's a greater sense of spaciousness, or a sense of clarity, greater sense of my own presence, my own being. Or as you go deeper, it's like, oh yes, here I am. You recognize here is that sense of I am-ness, which has been there all the time, it's there. So what we're doing when we're pausing is beginning to come back to our true nature. And as you do this, and we each do it in our own way, but just pausing, noticing how it is, what we notice is it's actually enjoyable. It's actually what we've been looking for all along, which we hoped the new jacket would get us, but was covered up by the wanting it, the missing it, the need. When we pause that, pause the thinking, pause the wanting, we begin to get in touch with what it is we're actually looking for all along, the happiness, the ease, the peace of mind, whatever you want to call it. And it's lovely. And so the next part of the practice is to actually savor that, to enjoy it, to actually pause. Ah, yes, this feels good. And to allow ourselves to sink into savoring it, recognizing that sense of feeling good, and to actually love it. We can actually begin to love our own inner sense of beingness. When we stop thinking, just in that moment, we just come back to that ease, that delicious quietness, stillness, spaciousness, whatever you want to call it. Then take time to actually love that, to really love it. Because the more we do that, the more we value it, the more attractive it becomes, the less we are drawn off into all these stories that society is continually telling us about what we need to be happy. So this, I think, is probably the... the most valuable application of love that we can apply in ourselves. There's many, many other areas of love, but to actually love our own essence is reinforcing our connection with that experience. Because you, in that sense, that I amness which is always there, that is the beloved. That is what we're looking for. The beloved is not out there, something to find out there. The beloved is our own true nature. You are the beloved. So we can begin to love our own nature. We are learning to love the beloved. And so to come back to the Beatles, nothing you can do, but you can learn to be you in time. It's easy. All you need
is love.
Thank you.